The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, friends, happy holidays, and welcome to this week's Reporters Roundtable on the Bill Press Pod. As always, a lot happening and a lot to talk about in our nation's capital, although much of the week's focus was on the never-seen-before destruction from the wave of tornadoes that hit the heartland. President Biden went down in person to see the damage and deliver federal help. But he's not receiving much help from Senator Joe Manchin, who still stands as the chief obstacle to getting Biden's Build Back Better plan passed by the end of the year. Now, some are predicting it'll never pass at all. Meanwhile, the January 6th Select Committee is in high gear, holding former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in contempt of Congress for refusing to answer their subpoena to testify. And Chris Wallace tells Fox News, take this job and shove it. All that and more for today's panel, so let's jump right in with Jason Dick, Deputy Editor of CQ Roll Call. Hi, Jason.
Morning, everybody.
Sharice Date, White House Correspondent for HuffPost. Hi, Sharice.
Hey there, Bill.
And from outside the Beltway, always welcome someone outside the Beltway, Melanie Mason, joining us from Los Angeles, National Political Correspondent for the LA Times. Hi, Melanie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, on CNN this morning, Alyssa Farah, former communications director for the Trump White House, revealed a text that she had sent Mark Meadows on January 6th, along with texts that he received from members of Congress, from the president's members of the president's family, and from some anchors on Fox News. Liz Cheney read some of those texts aloud at the big hearing of the January 6th committee, joined by Congressman Jamie Raskin.
Mark, protesters are literally storming the Capitol, breaking windows on our doors, rushing in. Is Trump going to say something? There's an armed standoff at the House chamber door. We are all helpless. Here's some more. This one came from Laura Ingraham. It was identified. Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy. Brian Kilmeade, please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished. Sean Hannity, can he make a statement, ask people to leave the Capitol? Donald Trump Jr., he's got to condemn this excrement ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough. Meadows responding, I'm pushing it hard, I agree. Donald Trump Jr., we need an Oval Office address. He has to lead now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand.
So, Jason, if we learn nothing else from that, we learn that a lot of people see Mark Meadows as right in the middle of things and the person who has the most influence on Donald Trump.
That's certainly one way to look at it. I mean, another way to look at it is if you covered Meadows in any capacity when he was a member of Congress, he gave out his number like candy at Halloween. I'm surprised there weren't, some sort of like writings on the bathroom for an insipid conversation. Call Mark at blah, 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 blah. Meadows has always been this person who presents himself as very accessible, gives out his phone number, talks to the press, talks to, his Democratic colleagues as well as the Republican colleagues. And so it's sort of not a surprise that a lot of people had that access. And then to your broader point, Bill, that people, were trying desperately to get him to intercede on behalf of the president. Well, they should have known better, because Meadows is not your kind of Rahm Emanuel, Leon Panetta type, Jim Baker type type of chief of staff who has his own power base and exercises it and acts as a gatekeeper. He's really more of an enabler and somebody who tells the president what he wants. And then it got to the point of January 6th, and then it revealed how little influence he really did have.
Right. I find it interesting that the pleas on the part of these people are not to save democracy or to save the Capitol, but to save Donald Trump's legacy or reputation. But Sharice, the president, President Biden, took the unusual step of stepping into this, actually, telling you reporters at the White House that he thought Mark Meadows deserved to be held in contempt. What does that say about Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice's likelihood to act?
I don't know if we can draw a direct inference from that necessarily,
mm-hmm.
but we have seen the president been pretty aggressive about saying, look, you know, what happened on January 6th was a travesty and it can never happen again. And things that relate to January 6th in the last administration, they don't deserve executive privilege because of the gravity of the situation. And also unsaid, but kind of implied is, you know, plotting a coup does not get you executive privilege. That's not a thing. And so I was not really surprised that the president said that. I mean, he is prone to saying things off the cuff sometimes. But in this situation, yeah, he's thinking that this is important and they ought to be looking at everything Mark Meadows did. And if Mark Meadows doesn't help, then he ought to be prosecuted for it. People were surprised how quickly the Justice Department turned around on the Bannon indictment. So, mm-hmm. you know, we'll see. People are predicting, oh, this is different. He's the chief of staff. You can't really go there. Well, I mean, look what Meadows has already said in his book. And he already turned over a bunch of incredibly incriminating texts and emails. So we'll see.
It also shows that Biden's following this pretty closely, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's interesting. Biden says stuff, and then when we try to get the press office to say, well, is the Justice Department doing anything or is there communication? Well, you know, that's up to the Justice Department. This is the darkest day in democracy. You know, the president's concerned, but we're not going to get into, you know, so they have their their talking points on that. But
yeah,
it has been interesting to see just how okay they are with calling what happened, using the terminology now that, you know, that's out there. This is basically a coup attempt.
Right.
And, you know, this ought not happen in a democracy.
Melanie, eyebrows were certainly raised by the text that came from Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, because they, at the same time on their TV shows on Fox News, they were putting down the seriousness of the attack on the Capitol, but they were frantically reaching out to Mark Meadows. When these texts came out, Sean Hannity took a different line of defense. How dare you release my text? Here he is.
By the way, where is the outrage in the media over my private text messages being released again publicly? Do we believe in privacy in this country? Apparently not.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, Melanie.
Yeah, that's an odd bit of pearl clutching. I know that there's obviously been quite a few news stories that Fox has covered pretty in depth that have required looking at people's private text messages. So for that to be the point of outrage, I think is pretty interesting. But I think there's just this sort of cognitive dissonance overall about how sort of I think the Fox News hosts tried to explain away the difference in tone that they had in these private messages as opposed to how they were on the air both that night and then, of course, 11 months later. And I think what for me watching this, what this really showed is it kind of brought you back to that day on January 6th. And it reminded you of the panic that people felt even watching this at home, not to say even at the Capitol even. And so if you're watching this, at least in good faith, it brings back that rush of emotions of just how unprecedented, just how terrifying that day was. Of course, the in good faith being, I think, the key line there. I think that if you're watching this and you are a Fox News host or if you're sort of their key audience, I think that they're very willing to sort of accept what is sort of a dissonant message of, you know, we thought this was terrible in private, but not that big a deal in public. And I think that goes to show that when you are in these sort of media bubbles, as the country is right now, I don't think that this core audience of Fox is going to abandon their favorite news hosts because these text messages have come out.
No, but it does really establish, doesn't it, and confirm that several of the Fox News hosts, we had Brian Kilmeade in here and probably Tucker Carlson, do serve as sort of informal advisors to the White House while they're talking about them on television.
Well, look, if I had text messages that were saying that this is damaging us, right? I mean, there's this sense that we're all in this together, to an administration official, I would be fired. But the truth is that, you know, journalism is not like medicine or it's not like law, right? I mean, there is not a professional board that you would report this to and say this violates our ethics. And generally, since I believe in the First Amendment, I think that that is a good thing, right? That there is not necessarily these universal standards. There are certainly ethical standards that we as reporters all try to hold ourselves to. But the truth is that there's no body that's going to adjudicate that. And so therefore you can have these very prominent journalists at Fox News do things that I think that other reporters would see as totally in violation of what are best practices as reporters. And there's no real consequences so long as their bosses don't see anything wrong with what they were doing.
Jason, would you fire one of your White House reporter if you found that he was sitting in the Oval Office giving Trump advice?
Yes. And I think as much power as I have to fire somebody. Yes,
I understand.
At a minimum, they would be, doing markup duty for the Indian Affairs Committee or something like that shortly thereafter. But I mean, to Melanie's point about like there is a moment of reaction, and then there was this sort of backup once they kind of remembered the ratings and the business and the sort of the facade that they've constructed at Fox, and even among some Republican members too, is that, you know, in the moment when you saw this horrific attack, they acted like human beings. They were like, oh my God, this is not something that like we've ever seen. Holy cow, we've got to get this stopped. And then once the dust settled, mm-hmm. and you know, they said, oh, only about 5 or 6 people have been killed, so we can, you know, kind of get back to business as usual here. And then, you know, that's when the sort of the cover up and they became implicit in this cover up of this attack on democracy. And that, I think that's the thing that's the most, you know, disturbing to me, and I know we're going to talk about Chris Wallace a little later, is that there is this, they just won't budge, you know, from this business model of really getting people pissed off and focused on how Biden is this villain and Democrats are their enemy, not the people trying to overthrow the government or trying to kill people in the speaker's lobby, but like the opposite political party. And that's just, that's what's so hard about listening to this and covering this story.
Let's resist the temptation to get into Chris Wallace right now. Save that, as you say, for a little bit later. But I want to come back to Wednesday. Sharish, you were on Air Force One covering the president's visit to Kentucky, down there with him. Can you describe for us what you saw?
It was out of this world. It was crazy. You know, I'm from Florida. I've spent most of my career down there, so I'm used to seeing hurricanes, and hurricanes do bad damage, of course. But what these tornadoes did was unbelievable. I mean, on both sides of the road we were driving through, there was not a structure standing, right? Mm. Things were absolutely flattened. Not only were they flattened, but all their contents had been pulled out and strewn all over the place. There was home insulation in the trees, in the tree branches. Bricks had come down. There were just these piles of rubble everywhere. People were rooting through them, sitting in front of them. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that that this president kind of does best. He empathizes with people. He talks to them like people. He hugs them. So, you know, it was probably, from a political view, it was probably a good moment for him. But, man, I cannot even imagine that happening to me or people I know. It was really kind of scary. Seeing that these things came out of nowhere, and all of a sudden, you know, everything that you've worked for your whole life is gone, and people were sitting there not knowing what to do.
Yeah, unbelievable video that we saw from those, as you say, the communities where nothing was left standing. And Jason, this brought an unusual moment in Washington, an unusual comment from the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, about President Biden's response.
President Biden cut through the red tape to approve our request at an accelerated pace, providing the rapid support we need to recover.
Oh, my God, Jason. Didn't hear much from Rand Paul, however.
No, not at all. But, you know, Mitch McConnell is always knows when to sort of cut a deal. Always knows when to, you know, say things at the right time for his own, you know, he knows the politics of his state very well. And he, I think that, you know, underneath it all, I mean, he obviously knows that this is a time when you need everybody sort of on the same page. And to his credit, you know, knows that like there's going to be plenty of times when he's going to drive the White House and the Democratic Party insane with whether it's hanging, you know, stalling judicial nominations or sort of gleefully celebrating the, you know, kind of apparent demise of Build Back Better as he did on the floor yesterday, the Senate floor. But in this case, I mean, his state is hurting, and he knows that, you know, he knows that Biden is the type of person who is going to try to get everything, you know, like, you know, sort of in order and aid there, and to his credit, sort of tipped his hat to it.
And meanwhile, this is Rand Paul, a remarkably silent Rand Paul who voted against federal help for Hurricane Sandy and other natural disasters, basically saying states should be on their own, find the money somewhere else. Awkward position for Rand Paul.
Oh, for sure. And this, you know, this shows sort of the limits of you know, the libertarian philosophy here of every person to himself or herself.
So, Melanie, if you look at it, I mean, Joe Biden has been hit with a flood, if you will, of natural disasters, the horrific wildfires in California, right? The tornadoes. This is not the first, these are the worst, but not the first wave of tornadoes. The flooding, the hurricanes. It's like locusts are the only thing lacking yet, right? But it's been a real challenge for him.
Right, but this is, unfortunately, I think that this is our new normal. I mean, it, in some ways, Mitch McConnell's words about President Biden reminded me of Governor Gavin Newsom speaking about Donald Trump back when we had the horrific wildfires. The truth is that partisanship sort of dissipates when disaster comes your way. And the truth is that disaster is coming more and more often. I do think that there is this impulse, and I think an understandable one, to say, you know, this is not the time for politics when people are trying to make sense of how their lives were destroyed. But it does feel like every time that one of these horrific events happen, particularly as we're seeing more and more extreme weather events, that we are potentially losing an opportunity to be talking about maybe some of the larger causes. And I think that particularly there's this reticence perhaps to talk about, you know, climate and some of the broader causes, because it looks maybe a little gauche to start talking about policy or political causes at this moment. But it does feel like whether it is President Biden or President Trump, the truth is that now we are in a cycle now of there is no just one disaster season. The disaster season is all four seasons of the year, and and it feels like it's only accelerating. So yes, this was a rough first year in office for President Biden on this front, but I don't think that he can anticipate things getting any better just looking at our track record so far.
Right, and climate change is here, and with climate change, disasters like this are going to continue and probably get even worse. Before we take a break here, there has been something hanging around Washington, Congress for a while. Build Back Better, it's called. It's now passed the House, but it's stuck in the Senate. And Shirish, the president yesterday seemed to indicate that he accepts the reality it ain't going to happen this year.
Right. Well, that's one of those things where the most important long-term stuff in that bill is probably having to do with climate change and dealing with the consequences of that. And I guess, you know, whether that happens next week or in 2 months, probably in the long term doesn't matter that much. Politically, I don't know. I think we within the Beltway get all hung up about, well, this bill didn't pass. It's a disaster for the Democrats or the Republicans or whatever. And outside, people have no idea what bill is being considered when and what's in it or why they should possibly care. If I could, though, on the point of climate change, you know, I covered Jeb Bush in Florida for 8 years, and I remember when he went out and got a hybrid SUV and was very proudly showing that a Republican governor could do his part to deal with energy conservation and climate change, et cetera. Charlie Crist, Republican governor of Florida at the time, and Arnold Schwarzenegger hosted a climate summit, right, in Miami to deal with these issues. And then suddenly, like a light switch, and Republican Party became the party of, this is not an issue, this is not a problem, it's all a hoax, and we're never going to do anything. And I thought, you know, when these things start hitting red states, that's when we'll see a change. And I think I'm wrong. I think we're going to deal with climate change the same way we deal with school shootings, which is we don't do anything. Nothing can be done because there will never be 61 votes in the Senate in order to make something happen.
Right. You could also mention the role of John McCain and George W. Bush, both of whom were climate change believers and thought the United States should take action. Again, their party never went along with them. Jason, you've pointed out that delay on Build Back Better is not the only thing happening in the Senate. There's been a long delay led by Ted Cruz on ambassadorial appointments. Any progress there? Are things loosening up?
So, you know, this delay has been almost a year long, you know, in the making. And a lot of it that Cruz in particular has been leading is about this Nord Stream 2 pipeline in Europe. And he does not think that the United States should be incentivizing a Russian pipeline to Europe. And so he and several other of his colleagues, Josh Hawley, Mike Lee, has sort of chipped in, have helped sort of blockade, particularly diplomatic nominees. And, you know, this sounds like a little inside baseball until you realize that it was only yesterday that Nicholas Burns, who had been nominated to be our top envoy to China, was confirmed. And also he was confirmed overwhelmingly. He was confirmed with 75 votes. So, I mean, this is one of those like sort of basic, you know, governance things that is being compromised by this totally intractable kind of opposition. And it's really damaging government. I mean, we're, you know, every president has hiccups and problems with the nomination process, but Biden's, I mean, his top envoy to China, our biggest rival on the global stage, was just confirmed yesterday, and it's almost Christmas. It's just insane that this is a way that you run government. But here we are, and they did confirm a few of these nominees last night. It looks like there might be a kind of a long day ahead of the Senate in confirming Schumer. Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, has been hesitant to sort of knuckle down and say like, okay, we're going to be here for 96 hours straight. order some takeout pizza because we're just going to keep voting, which I think would really alleviate the situation to get tough like that. But it sounds like they're going to do a big round of nominees and then probably go home for the season. But it doesn't eliminate the problem of having to go through this ridiculous process to just get your basic staff in place.
And it means that the ambassadors to many of our, not just China, but also many of our major allies, there's no ambassador there now because of this hold that Ted Cruz and others have put on the process. And for a personal note, it does get personal with the Bill Press Pod, because one of those people that's been held up for a year is our own Chris Liu, who was nominated as a deputy ambassador to the United Nations. And for some ungodly reason, he's on Ted Cruz's list. And so he's been in limbo for over a year now. And Chris, we hope that you get your nomination and your confirmation pretty soon and can get to work serving the people of the United States. On our panel today, Sharice Dati from HuffPost, Melanie Mason, The LA Times, Jason Dick from CQ Roll Call. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll be back and cover some of the rest of the news of the week here on today's Roundtable. And today's podcast, today's roundtable, is brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The great men and women of the Teamsters Union Under President Jim Hoffa, they are America's largest and most diverse labor union, representing everybody, as they say, in the American workforce from A to Z, from airline pilots to zookeepers. We thank the members of the Teamster for their great work building America, and particularly for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back here on the Bill Press Pod this Friday, December 17, with today's panel, Jason Tick from CQ Roll Call, Charisse Date, covering the White House for HuffPost, and Melanie Mason, national political correspondent for the LA Times. Melanie, California's Kamala Harris, former Attorney General of California, now Vice President of the United States, looking ahead at 2024, she says she and Joe Biden have never even discussed whether or not he might run for re-election. Melanie, you've covered Kamala. Can we believe that?
Perhaps they have not said the technical words, "Are you going to be running again in 2024? But yes, I think that that probably strains credulity that this was a conversation in some way that didn't come up or that hasn't been sort of talked around. But the truth is that what other kind of response do we expect when she gets a question like that? She is incredibly aware, as soon as she was named his vice presidential nominee, that looking like that Biden's loyal lieutenant was her number one job. And so any way that she could potentially look like she was looking out for her own political ambitions, political future, she was very, very wary to do anything that might appear that way. And so, of course, she's going to talk about how they're focused on the work ahead, that all this 2024 chatter that's going on is just political insiders. But the idea that this is not something that is very much on her mind and the mind of her advisors and inner circle, I think, is a little bit tough to swallow.
Right. Now, Charisse, inside the White House, I know in fact, I spoke with Jen Psaki, press secretary at our White House correspondents' holiday party the other night. You know, there's some frustration over what they consider unfair media coverage of the president. There's certainly a lot of concern about what they consider unfair media coverage of Kamala Harris. If anything, she's gotten a worse treatment than Joe Biden has. Is this a serious problem they see in the White House, and what's behind it?
Well, I can't speak to whether they see it's a serious problem or not. What's behind it is can you think of the last vice president that got really good press? And I can't. Maybe Al Gore didn't get terrible press, but What did we know about Dan Quayle? He got a strange doll from South America or Central America or someplace. He can't spell potato. this is the life of the vice president. It comes with the job of being demeaned and being ridiculed, et cetera. Regarding the press that the president gets, I think what they see, probably correctly so, is that he's being treated as a normal president. In other words, everything that goes wrong is his fault. And right now, you know, with the resurgence of the coronavirus and inflation, and even though the jobs picture is looking pretty good, then no one's paying attention to that because of the inflation. But, you know, if that turns around, he'll get credit for that. In fact, he got a lot of credit for the first 6 months of his presidency just for not being Donald Trump. But I think that's what they see, is that he's being compared to previous presidents, not the last one, but the ones before that. Right, he can't get his bill passed. He's not really a good communicator. He doesn't look great. He looks tired. What's with that cough? And meanwhile, the last guy tried to overthrow democracy, right? And so they think everything should be compared to that standard, and they probably have a point about that, given that he's still the leader of the Republican Party. So, you know, I get it, but on the other hand, the press corps is what it is, and it's going to have new content. Content is king every day. And if that day is the day that Joe Biden and Joe Manchin had a discussion and nothing got resolved, then that's the story.
So, Jason, the other inside the beltway of political infighting, if you will, that caught my attention this week was Donald Trump has been on a relentless effort to depose and knock out Mitch McConnell from his post as Senate Minority Leader. But yet so far, with all of Donald Trump's efforts, not one Republican senator has called for Mitch McConnell to step down, and only two Republican Senate candidates around the country have picked that up as part of their campaign pledge. So McConnell beating Trump? What does that tell us?
It's a little it is kind of an interesting situation, because, like, you know, you look at this weird hold that Trump has on his supporters, and then you see it's not something that I understand, but I do get that, like, Trump has this charisma that appeals to people. It doesn't appeal to a lot of people I know or myself, but I get that. And then you see McConnell, who's like sort of the anti-charisma guy, and you know, he is everything that Trump is not, and yet he has a potentially more ironclad sense of loyalty among his his Senate caucus. That may be because that job sucks. And most people don't want it, and they realize how difficult it is. Even some of the more hard charging young Turks, you know, in the Republican caucus, don't understand Senate procedure, don't understand how the place works nearly as well as McConnell will, and they may never get that either. So, I mean, he has the job of kind of keeping the caucus together and keeping the trains running on time. They certainly don't want to be there late at night in doing these things. So it's a little bit of that. And then also, the last thing is that McConnell raises an incredible amount of money, and he dispenses an incredible lot of money to their campaigns and supports them. So all those boring, you know, kind of governance and campaigning things, McConnell knows how to hit every last mark.
Well, and he's been doing it so far. All right. We said we were going to talk about Chris Wallace and the media. Now is the time. I guess, Melanie, if it were not Fox News and if it were not Chris Wallace, nobody would give a damn. But because it is Chris Wallace and because it is Fox News, this was big news this week.
Well, I think because Chris Wallace played a role in the Fox universe in a way that I think other anchors at other channels didn't quite play that role. I mean, so often when I think there was a lot of criticism about Fox's primetime lineup, for example, and the partisanship just sometimes the misinformation that we would see from that lineup, so often Fox could point to Chris Wallace and say, but this is a real newsman. I mean, this is somebody who really does conduct his show in a way that sort of aligns with journalistic standards. And so the fact that Fox can no longer point to Chris Wallace as being part of their lineup, I think really affects their branding in some sense. Now, will viewers of the channel care very much? I'm not so sure. It maybe feels like a little bit more of a media conversation and a Beltway conversation. But that said, I think that there was so many times where the channel pointed to Wallace as sort of a reputational laundering in a way that I don't think that other anchors serve that role for, say, a CNN or an MSNBC. And the second thing is just in terms of the media story, the fact that he was jumping to CNN streaming, I think really does talk about how the industry is changing. And the fact that CNN is going all in their streaming platform, the fact that they've made some high profile hires there. I mean, I do think that we are potentially looking at a remake of the industry. And so there's both a political story here, but also an industry story. And so if you're interested at all in sort of the business of news media, you were paying a lot of attention.
Right. So, Jason, Chris Wallace is gone. Stephen Hayes, as his contributor, also stepped down, as well as Jonah Goldberg. Who's left at Fox with any credibility, I should say?
I mean, I think that Brett Baer's reputation precedes him. I mean, he is a very solid newsman. But he I mean, no offense to him, he is not Chris Wallace. I mean, like, there is not a... It's difficult to find an analog for Chris Wallace because you have this, you know, incredibly sort of accomplished and articulate and smart and, you know, guy who's also Mike Wallace's kid. So, I mean, he has like this legacy glow to one of the most revered newsmen of all time. And then he has his own thing and he also like backed it up. So I think that it's not that there aren't journalists at Fox News. There are a dwindling number of them, but they have a hiring. They have an HR program that can reach out to people and hire as many as they want. But it'll be interesting to see where they go, because obviously they get a lot of advertising and a lot of viewers from the likes of Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and so forth. So I don't know how comfortable people like Baer are as the sort of the last folks, you know, like associated right. with like, you know, being straight news people. But it is certainly a problem for anybody who might be tuning in to think like I'm going to get some news, or as Melanie said, like there are fewer people for reputation laundering, which I love as an expression. Thank you, Melanie.
I'm glad you did not include Jerry Rivers, by the way, on your list of credible journalists at Fox News, but he's the one that Geraldo is the one that Sean Hannity always puts on, right, when he wants to show that we got some real progressives here, some real serious journalists. Charisse, in addition to Chris Wallace stepping down, Brian Williams a week ago said his sayonara as well, and he did, unlike Chris Wallace, he did not hold back. He really let loose on what he thinks is a situation in America today, unusual for a TV anchor to be so outspoken. But here is Brian Williams.
For the first time in my 62 years, my biggest worry is for my country. The truth is, I'm not a liberal or a conservative. I'm an institutionalist. I believe in this place, and in my love of country, I yield to no one. But the darkness on the edge of town has spread to the main roads and highways and neighborhoods. It's now at the local bar and the bowling alley, at the school board and the grocery store, and it must be acknowledged and answered for. Grown men and women who swore an oath to our Constitution, elected by their constituents, possessing the kinds of college degrees I could only dream of, have decided to join the mob and become something they are not, while hoping we somehow forget who they were. They've decided to burn it all down with us inside. That should scare you to no end as much as it scares an aging volunteer fireman.
So, Charisse, I know a lot of Democrats who said, boy, I wish we had a Democratic leader who could speak so forcefully and clearly. Proper role for Brian Williams?
In this case, absolutely. Absolutely. And, if you've seen my coverage, I've been focused on January 6th and why it happened. And it happened because of one guy, Donald Trump. Right. 232 years of elections, only one loser has decided, oh, no, well, I'm going to overthrow our form of republic rather than leave peacefully. And that's unacceptable. You know, journalist, firefighter, garbage collector, this is a representative democracy. And one of the rules is you would abide by the results of an election. And he fails to do that, doesn't want to do it. And he's being enabled by all kinds of people, including, I must say, a lot of people in the political press, in order to retain access. That's not right. And Brian Williams is 100% on when he said those things, and I wish others would say them as well.
And Melanie, what I heard in Brian Williams was sort of a plea to fellow journalists, right, to not to give this either-or situation, but really to take sides here.
I think that the sort of conventions of journalism are really being sort of tested in this moment, right? Because I do think that there was sometimes this pretty lazy framing, to be sure, which was kind of on the one hand. On the other hand, and I think that obviously, yeah, to Shirish's point, this is not a time where we can sort of say, you know, here are two strains of American thought, and they're both equally valid and equivalent to each other. But I also know this as a reporter that's out in the field, and that there is this. There is a sense of how do we reach as many people as possible in our reporting, and a sense of sometimes calling things out the way that they are because of this hyperpolarized climate, then almost automatically turns off a gigantic segment of this country in terms of regarding this reporting as truthful. And it's this real paradox, I think, for the news media, which is in calling things as they actually are, which is really fundamentally what our job is. We have now kind of as a society been so conditioned to seek out news that reinforces our prior biases that a lot of people, if reality doesn't jibe with their worldview, is just going to try and tune out on reality. And not only that, but denounce the people who are reporting on reality as being biased. And so I think that there is it's this really impossible situation, I think, for reporters. And quite frankly, it's something that I think that some cynical people in politics can really take advantage of and manipulate. And so I think that what Brian Williams' sort of clarion call is definitely the voice of somebody who is also not going to be serving in that role, at least in the current moment. It's a lot harder for people who are trying to make sure that they're not just talking to people who already think that they agree with them. And I think that struggle is where a lot of journalists find themselves right now, is trying to reach as many people as possible, even if they don't necessarily like what's being reported.
Yeah. Jason, what was your reaction when you heard Brian Williams?
I mean, I think that it's still a chilling sort of moment to even now to, you know, like with a few days to hear the words, because they do ring true. And I think that the thing to, you know, to Melanie's point about like how we approach our jobs. I mean, I think that a lot of, you know, obviously Williams has a lot of experience, you know, in covering politics, but we all do in our own ways. It's a struggle because, you know, the strain, the people like Trump have always been around in history, but they've never had this kind of voice and they've never had this kind of enabling. You know, Trump by himself could not do this. You know, could not have won the presidency, could not have done what he did as president, could not have done January 6th without enabling by the likes of Mark Meadows and Mike Pence and so forth. And that's the most disturbing thing to me, is that people like Trump, you know, are, you know, they're replete in history, but good people sort of team up and say like, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to overthrow the government. We're not going to allow people to be put in cages and on the border and families separated. And that just didn't happen. And it continues not to happen. And that's the real depressing legacy of this, is that the Republican Party writ large does not want to deal with this. They don't want to take him on. And that's why he's still so powerful.
Bill, if I could jump in here with one other item here real quick. You know, as a young journalist, I was taught, and I assume a lot others were, when you go to a school board meeting, a city council meeting, and they attempt to go to executive session in order to close off the public, it's your responsibility to stand up and say, as a member of the media and the public and an employee of such and such news organization, I object to this, and please hold off until we can get our lawyers. Now, this is not something that I was just taught. This was like most of my cohorts. And so if we can like
argue for our self-interest and the interests of the public in situations like that, we sure as hell can argue for the sake of democracy in a situation like we find ourselves in today.
And that's it for today's panel. Charisse Date, Jason Dick, Melanie Mason, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your insights. We won't let you go, however. Before we just ask you, you know, with all the stuff that we cover every week, there's always one story that makes us stop in our tracks and at least think about it, laugh about it, cry about it, whatever. We call it our favorite story of the week. Melanie Mason, what caught your attention?
This is cheating a little bit because this is actually a story that ran in June, but because it's the end of the year and people are doing sort of their year-end reviews.
That's fair.
The LA Times has put together their sort of best of our sort of narrative writing. We have this feature called Column One, which is really kind of the best for our writing. And there was a feature by my colleague Maria Laganga back in June about Carl, who was a worker in a hospital who collects the bodies of COVID victims. And it is, yes, it's a hard read, but I have to say that even for people who are feeling really exhausted by COVID coverage, it is written in such a way that is so sensitive and affirming and really kind of lovely. And I would just say for anybody who is interested in really, really great writing and who can power past what is, I think, all of our COVID fatigue to really appreciate some of the stories that went uncovered. Maria's piece is just truly wonderful. So I cannot recommend it enough. And it's under stories that stayed with us on our homepage. So I would encourage people to take a look at that.
All right. We'll find it there. Thank you. Charisse Date, your favorite story of the week?
Maria Laganga, I remember her. I interned in that office in Orange County.
No way. Reporter.
This was like in the mid-80s. Yeah, it's wild. Bill, I have no favorite stories. I hate reading. You know, I don't even know why I'm in this business. But I must say that all the stuff about Mark Meadows, my favorite story about Mark Meadows is kind of old, but it speaks to this exactly. After he tried a coup against John Boehner, he went in and begged for forgiveness, getting on his knees in the speaker's office. So that's all you need to know about Mark Meadows and explains his behavior in this coup as well.
That tells you a lot about him. All right, Jason, it's probably some movie that none of us have seen. It was your favorite story, no?
That is correct, Bill. As I said, I am going with a movie one, and it's a shout out to one of Melanie's colleagues at the Los Angeles Times. I was fortunate enough to see a sneak preview on 70 millimeter of Licorice Pizza, Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie with Alana Haim and Cooper Hoffman. It's a really good movie. And then in the LA Times, one of their arts and culture writers, Deborah Vanken, she wrote a story about the poster art and the artist, this woman named Kat Reeder, whose father came to this country in the 70s from Peru. And it's a really nice story about how she got involved in, or how she decided to do up this poster. I mean, a lot of movie poster art is photography based. That we don't do a lot of artistic things, and this poster in particular has gone kind of viral. People quite literally like rip it off walls and so forth because they want it because it's so fun. It's an illustration of the cast, and it's just a fun, light story. And after reading, you know, Mark Meadows texts and so forth, I just needed some light and sort of affirming thing. And this is a fun story.
I'm glad you found it. And my favorite story of the week is, I know Donald Trump has a big smile on his face because we discovered this week that there was voter fraud in the 2020 election. Of course, AP this week reported that they did a survey of the six battleground states where Trump challenged the vote count. And out of those six battleground states and 311,257 votes cast, there were only 475 possible cases of voter fraud. But despite that, in Florida, they found three solid cases of voter fraud. They were all from The Villages, which is a senior citizen retirement community in Florida that Donald Trump visited twice during the campaign. All three of these seniors were arrested for voting in more than once and in more than one state. and all three of them were Donald Trump supporters. So, yes, Donald Trump, there was voter fraud. You'll be pleased about that, but you may not be pleased that they were all your people. And that's it for today's podcast, for today's roundtable. Thanks again to Jason Dick from CQ Roll Call, Sharice Date from HuffPost, Melanie Mason from the LA Times. And thanks to all of you for joining us. Take care of yourselves. Enjoy this holiday season. And then come back and see us, please, on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.